Hey there, and welcome to episode 2 of the Blocks Decoded podcast. I'm here with Dan.
Hello.
Gavin.
Hello.
And James.
Hey, hello.
So, if this is your first time joining us on our podcast, welcome. We hope to see you in the future, and this is the second of our podcasts, as I've already mentioned. So you can check out our first episode up on the Blocks Decoded website or in the podcast notes. So today we're going to look at a few news articles. We're going to look at the Bitcoin generation SEC freeze. We're going to look at the continued adventures of Craig Wright. And then we're going to look at the Jaguar Land Rover potential IOTA partnership. Moving on to articles, we're going to take a quick look at the Binance coin study, crypto trading on Robinhood and whether it's really free. And then we're going to finish up with a quick look at Tron and whether you should be using this coin. So let's get started. So in the news this week, yesterday in fact, it's come to light that the SEC in America has frozen trading on the Bitcoin generation exchange. So this is very interesting because, you know, Bitcoin is supposed to be unstoppable, yet here we are getting it frozen. So what do you guys think of that?
So the SEC said that it had concerns regarding the viability and valuation of a bond that Bitcoin Generation purportedly acquired from an entity based in the United Kingdom, which, like, is quite vague. It's not entirely sure what that means, even.
No, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? They've nailed this particular company. Possibly they're doing something wrong in the background. I suspect they're one of many doing something wrong. Yeah, let's see where it goes. I mean, they've been suspended, so let's see what happens.
Do you think it's more that the process that this particular exchange is offering itself to investors is against the current SEC rulings, whereas if you're buying Bitcoin, a Bitcoin, you are literally investing in the cryptocurrency, whereas Bitcoin generation, from what I understand, is actually offering shares within the company of Bitcoin generation exchange, but they haven't done that in the manner that the SEC prefers. So they've been shut down pending further investigation, but it's not to say that they won't eventually come back online, but there is obviously going to be a long investigation seeing how that's affected the investors they've already taken on.
Yeah, exactly. So for the meantime, if you wanted to buy any more of those shares, that is actually now illegal, or rather is, you know, illegal in certain countries. And even if it's legal in your country, you won't be able to buy them. The company aren't trading them anymore.
Go on.
I was going to say, it's interesting because it's a company trying to bridge that gap, isn't it, between being an institutional investment and a cryptocurrency investment, but it seems that they've gone about it in the wrong manner.
Well, it shows the two fields of crypto and traditional equities coming closer together, you know, and it makes it possibly shines a light on how silly it is, if silly is the right word, to have all the regulations in the traditional sector and none of it in the crypto sector. As the two sectors come closer together, you know, you suspect that the regulation will increase in both. And that will hopefully stop some of this happening.
Yeah, interestingly, there was a survey released today that found that 27% of those aged 18 to 34, that's the millennial bracket, I guess, isn't it? Prefer Bitcoin investment over stocks. The study, it doesn't actually say how many people it took in. So, I mean, they could have taken a really uneven swipe of the market. But it is an interesting study nonetheless. And it also showed that a lot of people are much more aware of Bitcoin than they were just two years ago. But I guess that's much to do with the massive boom and the surge in price and corresponding crash afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What's interesting about this particular story is that you kind of have to have, if you're investing in crypto and you've always kind of been in the crypto space and then you've got into buying more crypto and that was primarily what you use in the platform for, you now have to have an awareness of like what financial jargon is being used that is regulated, and it gets a bit confusing. Like, I know a little bit about securities and things like that, but if you just read the what has happened to Bitcoin generation. They were selling securities, and it's not immediately clear like what that is unless you've been into traditional finance before. So it's also going to be quite a tricky thing for people to navigate from the traditional side going into crypto and crypto going into traditional.
Yeah, we saw this, it's almost exactly like we saw last week with Bakkt. You know, it's really good exchange, but it's not open yet because they don't have permission. It's kind of like, you know, once you start getting into that traditional finance sector, it's uncharted territory.
Yeah, and BitThumb last year were looking to do something similar. They wanted to list as a publicly traded stock so that people could buy shares in them. But then, of course, they got hacked and there was a lot of other shady stuff going on. So eventually, I think they were going to be listed in Singapore or somewhere like that. And it all went very cold after people realised that things at BitThumb weren't quite looking so rosy. But that, I think that's probably going to be the difficult thing for a lot of people that want to invest in cryptocurrency, is finding things that do appear legitimate and will maintain their legitimacy whilst they're being invested in. Because a lot of stuff appears fantastic for a year or two and then suddenly, oh, it turns out it's an exit scam, or the CEO, you know, ends up in jail or whatever. I mean, that happens to regular businesses anyway, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, more so with crypto.
Yeah, yeah, it does seem to be more.
Especially when the prices are high.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
Oh, so moving on to the Craig Wright saga. When will it end? You know, you've got Game of Thrones and you've got Avengers Endgame and now we've got Craig Wright. So this week, yesterday again, after getting delisted on all the exchanges which we discussed in our last episode, he has now come out slamming Binance, and he said that they're involved in wash trading and money laundering. So he calls them a super bucket shop. Trades, money launder, and that's how they make money.
So, I mean, plus one for his use of language, I've got to say. That's fantastic.
Well, and then he calls, John McAfee Mr. Conman.
I mean,
fairly accurate.
Yeah, I mean, the list of tweets that you see him firing off there, I mean, it's rapid fire, isn't it? It's just an onslaught. Whether or not he's... as we said last week, whether he's got an end game for where he's going with this, I'm not entirely sure, but it's entertaining as hell to watch, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much, if you tweet about him or at him, he's just going to come after you as well.
Reminds you of a certain world leader.
Yeah.
I'm particularly enjoying his other quote that we've got here, which is, "This is why they don't want me talking. They want to shut me up because this is a criminal organisation."
It's a conspiracy, I mean, I tell you.
He definitely sounds as if he might be Satoshi. I mean, I'm not sure, but these crazy tweets and, you know, sounding more and more unhinged, it definitely sounds like the kind of person that might have started the blockchain.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're just covering yourself there, mate.
I don't think he's wrong in everything he tweets. You know, there's so many conspiracy theories, some of them have to be right. But when he talks about, he also blamed Kraken and Shapeshift exchanges for money laundering. But what interests me is when he's talking about everyone pumping money through Tether, and he calls that a criminal money laundering system. And I'd be inclined to agree with that. I think Tether is super shady.
Absolutely. The exchanges that he references as well, I mean, let's be honest about it. There is clearly money laundering going on in those exchanges. To what extent, we don't know. But, I mean, it is clearly happening. It is clearly happening. So
the interesting thing about this is that he's still reasonably claiming to be Satoshi. That's what he says. And it's almost as if he forgets that Bitcoin was kind of, until 2 years ago, Bitcoin was basically famous for being used in illegal transactions. So he doesn't really have any particular high ground if he were to be Satoshi anyway.
Building on that as well, he seems to consistently forget that Satoshi, whoever it would be, would presumably be decent at encryption and signing their emails with the correct keys and what have you. But he submitted some emails to one of the court cases he was in that had been tampered with, forgetting that the metadata of the email is encrypted in it with the PGP keys that he signed them with, his personal ones rather than the alleged Satoshi ones. So he tried to doctor the emails, forgetting that anybody else could look at what had been doctored. It's phenomenal, really.
Yeah, the fact that he just has to make a transaction from Satoshi's address,
yeah,
and everyone would believe him. It's like, it's just a bit crazy. I wonder where it will end.
The one thing I wanted to add on the end of that, though, was just what if it is him? What happens to the price of Bitcoin, and what happens to the price of Bitcoin SV? You know, does Bitcoin collapse overnight? And do we finally have Satoshi? You know.
Yeah, but why would he be like, you know what? I'm bored. 10 years later, I'm just gonna come cause some trouble.
He's just shaking it up, man.
Perhaps he just rolled a dice. He wrote down a load of crazy stuff and was like, "Oh, what should I do today?" There's no doubt he's a very clever guy, but maybe he needs to work on his social skills. So, moving on to the last of our news stories for today. Again, released yesterday or so. This is the story about Jaguar Land Rover planning to allow car drivers to earn cryptocurrency. And they'll be doing this through IOTA. And the idea is that if you share your driving data or statistics and things like potholes and traffic, they'll pay you, presumably a very small fee, in IOTA, which is a really interesting concept. And certainly, you know, Jaguar Land Rover are a massive company. So this smart wallet, as they call it, which they're going to start installing into some trial cars, certainly has a lot of potential.
Yeah, I think this is great. One of the criticisms that's always been levelled at Facebook and so on has always been, well, they're taking all your money. Sorry, they're taking all your data and you're not getting anything in return. Well, now you're getting paid in return, you know. When I was researching for talking about this piece, I was reading it as criticism that people were selling their data. Well, I don't think that's a criticism at all. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to be collected and sold, and you know you're going to have to do it regardless, you may as well have received something in return for it, you know, especially if it's going directly into a smart wallet. I like that they're going to try and build it into toll road systems and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. So you can earn it for reporting the pothole 20 miles up the road, and then you can get through the toll barrier straight away afterwards. So that's quite nice.
Do you have any thoughts on that, James?
No, I agree with pretty much everything anyone's said. It's a pretty cool idea. I think that, like Dan said, the ability to actually make money off your data is pretty cool. And if they give you options in order to say what kinds of data you're willing to share, like for me, I probably wouldn't want to share location data, but I would probably not mind saying there's a pothole here or something like that. And if that kind of system was to work, that would be phenomenal. And it would, instead of cities having to build sensors into everything to make this sort of Internet of Things smart city, you could just build it into the car instead, and you're incentivizing people to collect that data. It keeps the cost down, but also gets all the positives from it as well. So I think it sounds like a brilliant idea.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm quite a big fan of Jaguar Land Rover because I own a Land Rover. I also do a lot of driving. I do about 90 miles a day in the countryside with terrible, terrible roads. Like, I go through so many potholes.
Wow.
And when I'm in my smaller car, I go through easy, you know, 2 tyres a year just from potholes.
Wow.
They're that bad around me. So if I can have my car be like, oh, there's a pothole, you know, I'll just get it reported. I don't know if they'll fix it because, you know, local government, but at least they'd know about it because I can't be bothered to tell them. There's too many.
And you'd have to know where it was as well, which you can't really do when you're driving, whereas the car could.
Well, and they're on the whole road.
Yeah.
Can't be just
I mean, I don't know how this would work with regards to other companies. Is there going to be proprietary technology for every car? Is it going to be the same system everywhere? I mean, those kinds of questions are really important to make it less of a marketing gimmick, like, oh, look, we're doing this now, to actually becoming something useful.
Yeah, so from the looks of it, Jaguar Land Rover are saying they can fit it to any new car. And IOTA are saying they want to use the same technology on every car. So you don't have a Jaguar coin or a BMW coin. You just have your Universal coin or your UK coin. All right, so let's take a look at some of our recently published articles. And Gavin is going to give us a quick rundown of Binance Coin, what that is and how it works.
Yeah, so Binance Coin has been catching a lot of news recently. It's understandable. It entered the market towards the end of last year. It's the official cryptocurrency of the Binance Exchange. Question you often hear is, why on earth would you use a cryptocurrency that's dedicated to one exchange? Well, if you use Binance Coin on the Binance Exchange, your exchange fees receive a massive, massive discount. So it works out in the first year on the Binance Exchange using Binance Coin, you receive a 50% fee discount. In year two, it's 25%. Year three, 12.5%. Year four, 6.75%. And in year five, there is no discount. Now, you can obviously see that that's decreasing a fair amount from the top. The discount level is dropping over time because Binance foresee the value of the coin rising. They initially expected it to probably fall with time, and I think they've kind of been taken aback with how popular it actually became. They are also doing token burns periodically. I think it's once every quarter. They're destroying, I can't remember how many coins it is per quarter. The last one was 1.6 odd million coins. And they're going up to 100 million tokens. Now, 100 million tokens will be half of the entire supply of Binance coins. So by constricting the supply, they should manage to keep the value of the coin relatively stable. You can also use Binance Coin in several other places. You can purchase digital gifts on the UpLive video streaming service. If you happen to be floating around Brisbane Airport, you can use Binance Coin to purchase various products. There's a crypto point of sale solution called Pundi X, which accepts Binance Coin. And you can also use Binance Coin to secure a loan through the crypto loan service called Nexo. So you basically give them a stack of your Binance coins, and in exchange, they give you a stack of fiat, but I mean, obviously you have to pay it back. Don't think about it in a, you get a bunch of free money way. So yeah, Binance Coin also has a partnership with the crypto Visa card company Monaco, who we've not really talked about yet in a podcast, but I feel like maybe we'll cover that in the future. And you can spend your Binance Coin using a Monaco Visa card or via the Monaco mobile app. The Binance Decentralized Exchange, which has only just launched, and at the current time you can only trade Mithril, which I'm not actually sure what Mithril does, is the only thing you can trade against it on the Binance Decentralized Exchange. But when the Decentralized Exchange starts taking on more and more listings, you'll be able to use the Binance Coin to trade specifically on there. And I think that also comes with the additional bonus of the transaction fee reductions. So overall, it's shaping up to look pretty nice for Binance and Changpeng Zhao.
Yeah, so I think Binance Coin is potentially very desirable. You know, there's only 200 million of them. It's going to go down to 100 million. That's, you know, still a lot. It's about triple what you can find for Bitcoin, but it's not like 100 billion or 200 billion. It's still slightly limited, slightly rarer. So, and I think that's reflected in the price.
So just on that then, what's the mechanism behind going from 200 million to 100 million? I mean, if you wanted to restrict supply, why not just start off with 100 million?
I think it's, they start off high and do the coin burn process to counteract the effect of the decreasing discount. The idea is that it creates stability over time by limiting the supply. why not start with 100 to begin with? I think so that more people could use it straight away. They don't want to create a massive, massive price bump to begin with. The price did rise. It had an all-time high of $24.46. But since that time, it's kind of peaked up and down. But last month, it was just below $20. So more money is piling into it than I think Binance were expecting.
This might be an obvious question, but so the limit gets down to 100 million in however long it may be. And then what? How do they then control the price? Surely they're just bumping the problem of stability down the road a little bit, are they not?
The way I see it is that once it becomes something that's being traded more frequently on the actual decentralized exchange, rather than people buying it as a specific token that they are holding on to, there's going to be a lot more fluidity with it that should theoretically dictate the price, rather than, yeah, like I said, just people using it as something to make a quick profit on in case it rises. Mm-hmm. So that should maintain it at least a stable price. But I mean, as you've seen with other cryptocurrencies all the time, they can rise overnight, and there's always the pump and dump groups. Although I think something like Binance Coin would be a bit more resilient to a pump and dump group just by way of its day-to-day trading volume.
Brilliant. So, moving on, Dan, what is Robinhood and why isn't it really free if you do your trading?
So, Robinhood is something I looked at for our sister site Make Use Of a few months ago, and I thought I would revisit the topic from a crypto angle recently on our site. Robinhood obviously sprung to prominence a few years ago now as a place to trade stocks for free. So rather than being charged a few dollars for every trade, as you would with the traditional discount brokers on the web, your trades would be entirely free of charge on Robinhood. Very successful, obviously, especially amongst the millennial market. And so fast forward to February last year, February 2018, and Robinhood launched a crypto division. Initially, it was very limited, just in states around the US, but over the last 12 months, that's grown significantly. Most places in the US, you can now buy crypto through Robinhood, and I believe they have plans to go into the UK market very soon as well. So companies worth $2 billion, 3.5 million users, you know, it's now offering most of the top cryptocurrencies that everyone recognizes. And it's very popular because if you compare the prices to a service like Coinbase, which is obviously probably the most well-known on-ramp for cryptocurrency purchases, it's a lot cheaper. I mean, in the article here I've covered, Coinbase charges 99 cents if the transaction amount is less than $10, up to $2.99 if it's more than 50 but less than $200. So Robinhood doesn't charge those fees. Crypto is free. Great. Everyone wants to be a part of it. But scratch below the surface a little bit, and there is some controversy there. Not controversy, but some questionable practices, shall we say. And it all boils down to a process called payment for order flow, which is essentially when you make a trade on a service like Robinhood, they being Robinhood, can direct your orders to high-frequency trading firms, market makers, and so on. And they are the people that ultimately are responsible for executing your trade. The market makers, they want that data to understand where the retail money is going. It gives them a better insight into the markets. So they can make more money. And they pay for those orders. So they pay Robinhood for Robinhood to send your trades to them. Sounds controversial, a process pioneered by one Bernie Madoff, which probably tells you all you need to know really about where the sort of roots of that process lie. But in 1999, it was officially adopted by the New York Stock Exchange. So it might be controversial, but it is very much now common practice. So how does this link back to Robinhood? Well, SEC rules dictate that companies, exchanges, have to reveal to the customer when they are doing this payment for order flow, when they're receiving money for their orders. Robinhood didn't. It took until a Bloomberg investigation in October 2018 for them to reveal this at all on their website and for them to change their terms of service and so on. And the figures behind this from Robinhood's perspective are remarkable. I'm going to pull it up here. So to compare it to E-Trade, which is obviously one of the main discount brokers online in the US, they make about $22 per $1 million traded through payment for order flow. They report that in price per share, so it's $22 per $1 million traded. Robinhood uses price per dollar of executed trade value instead to represent, sorry, to report how much money they're earning from this payment for order flow, which makes it look artificially small on their accounts. However, if you used the same process, they would be getting paid, same reporting process, they would be getting paid $260 per $1 million traded.
Wow.
So that's 22 versus 260. And if Robinhood did as much trade volume as E-Trade, they would be making close to $500 million per quarter. $500 million per quarter in payments from these market makers and high-frequency trading firms. That everything we've spoken about so far there, mainly related to traditional stock trading. Under SEC laws, policies at the moment, they do not have to reveal or report their payment for order flow regarding crypto. So one can only imagine what is going on and the figures involved on the crypto side of things, where there's just no transparency at all and they can just reap in this reward without telling anyone. So that's the problem. You're ultimately, as an end user, you're going to pay a higher cost because people get advanced knowledge of your trades. They can move the market in ways you don't necessarily want them to. So all this is going on behind the scenes, and ultimately, as an end user, you're paying the price.
There's a saying with free stuff, isn't there? You know, they say it about Facebook, that if you're not paying for the service, you are the service.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. So moving on to our final article of today's podcast, we're going to take a quick look at Tron. So you may have heard of Tron, and it's got a bit of a funny name if you're a fan of the movie. But it's totally unrelated. Tron is aiming with a very ambitious aim, building a decentralized. So that goal is perhaps a bit far off into the future. But obviously the only way you can get there is just doing little steps at a time, which is what Tron are aiming to do. So they believe the way they can do this is if they start with content creators, and that content creators can push content, be it films or games or media, and then users can pay for that service using Tron or the TRX token, which is a great idea. And to do that, you're going to need some high performance, right? Because you can't be just sort of waiting 10 seconds if you want the whole internet to run on it.
Sure.
So they currently operate at 2,000 transactions per second. And to put that in perspective, Bitcoin does about 3 to 6 transactions per second, and Ethereum has 25.
Wow, that is fast.
Yeah, but to accompany that, they have 100 billion tokens, which is quite a lot. But then they haven't been around very long. They only launched their mainnet in May 2018 and mined their first Genesis block in June 2018, so they're just coming up to of production-ready network status. But since then, they have acquired BitTorrent, and they've reached 100 million transactions in December 2018. So things are going very well for Tron, helped in part by their charismatic CEO, Justin Sun, who you may know. He was a graduate of Jack Ma's university, and he's a former advisor to Ripple Labs, so Ripple's XRP. He had a lot of involvement with, which seems like a lot of other people have had involvement with Ripple. So moving on to how Tron works, if you read our podcast notes, you can see the link to our article and the link to their white paper. But essentially, it's a smart contract system. It's very similar to Ethereum, but it uses, it requires developers to actually write and deploy decentralized apps to run a smart contract. So without developers, nothing's really going to work. And they have, they split this code into 3 tiers. We'll just very quickly cover those if you're not bothered about the technical stuff, it's worth learning about. So they have an application layer, a storage layer, and a core layer. So the application layer is where developers will deploy their decentralized apps. And the storage layer is where developers will store their app data. And this is split into two parts. Blockchain storage to store all your data in more of a traditional way. And then a state storage, which is just a very, very fast way of storing data. And it's just a temporary storage if, you know, if a transaction or something's not working out or there's a newly forked chain, it gets temporarily stored here until everything's all settled down. And then it gets pushed to the but slower storage on the network. And then it uses a Tron virtual machine, which is like the Ethereum virtual machine. And it just makes things very easy for developers to produce dApps running on their machine, so they know code they write is going to respond the same way on their computer as it does when it gets to the network. So all stuff to make developers' lives easier. And then finally, Tron uses a delegated proof of stake consensus algorithm. So many places or many projects use proof of stake. So the more coins you have, you can stake them on a super representative and you'll get a reward every time a block is mined. But with Tron's delegated proof of stake, you vote for your super representative who gets reward, and then they decide what to do with the reward. So many of them will distribute it back to you, but others may give it to charity or fund their own projects. But the best part is if they do something you don't like, you get to vote for them again every 6 hours. So you can take your coins, stake them on a different representative who will actually, you know, give you a reward if that's what you want.
Tron's actually got a very healthy dApp ecosystem already, hasn't it? There's a lot of games already been released using Tron as the payment system. I mean, lots of them are the gambling apps and what have you, but some of them are actually MMOs and other more interactive type games. So there's a lot of different bits and bobs out there.
Yeah, and if you follow Justin Sun on Twitter, he's very well liked by a lot of people in the community, and he has a lot of big friends, obviously Jack Ma being the biggest friend of his. But he's got some powerful friends and he really knows his stuff. So I'm confident that under his leadership, Tron's got a lot of potential.
Yeah, there was a bit with him with Tim Berners-Lee as well, wasn't there? So, I mean, if you're going to be friends with anyone, the founder of the internet as we know it is probably quite a good guy to know.
Yeah, perhaps he's asking for some tips.
I would agree with you and say that amongst all the sort of emerging cryptocurrencies of the last year and a half, Tron really is looking quite exciting.
That it is. So moving on, that is us done for this week for the Blocks Decoded podcast. Thank you for joining us and giving us your valuable time. If you're interested in any of the stories we've discussed, you can check out the podcast notes. You can read our full articles and our coverage. And as always, make sure you keep an eye on the Blocks Decoded website, where you can read our regular 3 times a week articles. And we'll be publishing new podcasts every 2 weeks. So it's thank you from all of us here.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
Cheers.
And we'll see you in the next one.